This is ProBlogger.
Hi there and welcome to episode 193 of the ProBlogger podcast. My name's Darren Rouse and I'm the blogger behind ProBlogger.com, a blog, podcast, event, job board and a series of ebooks all designed to help you to create an amazing blog, a profitable blog. You can learn more about ProBlogger at ProBlogger.com. Now, in today's episode, I want to explore the topic of being a prolific content creator by interviewing one of my favorite online buddies, Kelly Exeter, about her experience of creating content online. Now, many of you will be familiar with Kelly because she's been a regular writer on the ProBlogger blog for a year or two now, where she writes on blog design and creating content. She's also presented an episode of this podcast. You might remember back in episode 119, I let her take over the show for the day, and she talked about how to choose a WordPress theme that is going to be effective for you. She's also presented a number of times at our Australian ProBlogger events. So many of you will know Kelly, and you'll know that she has different hats that she wears. Now, I first came across Kelly when she was wearing her hat as a blog designer. She was designing quite a few Australian bloggers, quite well-known bloggers. She actually designed Vanessa's blog as well. We loved her design so much. But since that time, I've watched her put on many other hats, and I really do mean many other hats. She is a blogger. She regularly blogs on her own blog at kellyexeter.com.au. She also guest posts on quite a few blogs, including ProBlogger. She co-hosts two podcasts. She's been editing the Flying Solo website. And over the last 3 years, she's managed to write 3 books as well. So she is prolific. She is creating a lot of content in different mediums. So today, I sat down with Kelly to explore this journey that she's been on. We started off tackling the question that I get asked a lot: how personal should you get on a blog? And I wanted to ask Kelly on this question because she's someone who has changed her tack on that. She was very personal when she first started out. She talked a lot about quite personal things, but in recent times she's changed her approach. So we unpacked that a little bit. We then talked about her writing process, where she talks about another change that she's made. She's actually changed her approach from being a very structured writer, having outlines, to using free writing. And she talks a little bit about that technique and how she does that. We've got some further reading in the show notes on that as well. My favorite quote from that particular section was, "Let yourself write crappy words." I love that part of this particular interview. It's something that I learned a lot from and I was quite challenged on. We talk about editorial calendars. We talk about what to do when you start second guessing yourself in the writing process and researching posts as well. We talk about then her experience of writing the longer form content, like the 3 books that she's written, and how her approach again has changed in that. And we then talk about podcasting, why she started, how that workflow works for her, and how podcasts and blogs are different from one another. And then lastly, we talk about the unifying theme, I think, of this podcast, and that is prolific content creation. And Kelly reflects upon some of her systems and routines and techniques for getting so much done, because she does get a lot done. All of that I've just talked about, plus she's a runner, she's a mum, she is a reader, and she does get a lot done as well. She's very disciplined, or at least comes across that way, and we talk a little bit about how to become more disciplined. So we cover a lot of ground over the next hour. If you think that sounds like a lot, you are right. I originally did consider splitting this episode into some shorter episodes, but I think there's this unifying theme there of being a prolific content creator. And I think together it kind of comes across and you'll see some themes coming up again and again. So settle in. This episode does take a little while. You may actually want to pause it halfway and continue it. Or if you're someone like me who takes long walks, this will be perfect for you. There is so much value here. I actually got a lot out of it myself and have already changed a couple of things in my own writing process. Now, by the way, Kelly is one of the speakers at this year's Australian ProBlogger event. She's talking about content creation and she always gives a lot of value. So if you want to learn more about that event, head over to ProBlogger.com/events Today's show notes are at problogger.com/podcast/193, where there is some links to some further reading that Kelly mentions along the way, as well as some other stuff that Kelly has written that you might find useful. And lastly, join the Facebook group, problogger.com/group. We're seeing a lot of activity in there. I'm loving that group at the moment, and really do look forward to connecting with you there. All of that is linked to on the show notes as well. But I'm going to get into this interview now. Settle in, grab your favorite beverage, or get out on a walk and enjoy this chat that I have with Kelly Exeter.
Creating great content. Finding an audience. Building engagement. Monetizing your blog. This is ProBlogger.
Hi, Kelly. How are you?
Hey, Darren. Very good, thank you.
It's nice to see your football team won last on the weekend.
I know, and yours as well. Like, yeah, it was funny. We've got a Carlton supporter in our office, and like, so I went into work yesterday morning, and I was like, everybody's team won. How unusual is that with a Dockers supporter and a Carlton supporter in the office?
Very good. But no one here is wanting to hear us talk about football, so maybe we'll get on to talking about blogging.
Alrighty.
I wanted just quite a bit of a few of our audience will be familiar with you because you do appear on ProBlogger and you've been on the podcast previously. But I just wondered if you can give us the 2-minute version of how you got into blogging, why you started, and what that first blog was about.
All right. So the reason I got into blogging was, so I have a graphic and web design business, and so 7 years ago now, I had just had a meeting with my staff to say, look, guys, I think it would be really good if you guys each started a blog because we're building sites in WordPress, and it would be really good if you were across WordPress, et cetera, et cetera. I was already across WordPress doing stuff for other people, but I didn't have anything of my own at the time. Because at that time in my life, I was totally overwhelmed and had way too much going on. I didn't have time to be starting a blog. But of course, I went home that night and I thought to myself, I told all of my staff to start a blog. Maybe I should start one too. And because of course, that's what you do when you have no time. So being me, I like right there and then I created the blog because I could. And it was called I Love Pretty Things. And I saw it as an opportunity because I do that literally love pretty things, but I don't like stuff in my house. So, you know, I love going to art markets and things like that and looking at all the beautiful things, but I don't like buying them. So I was like, oh, this blog will give me the excuse to go to all these art markets and write about these things, even if I don't buy them. So yes, I remember my very, very first post was about more MOR products and, you know, how beautiful they are because it's got all the beautiful packaging. And then, yeah, that was my first blog. I love pretty things. I'd love to know how many people remember that one.
Yeah, I didn't even know about that one. So yeah. I started off as a style blogger.
Oh, yeah, as kind of, yeah, it was funny. It got traction really, really quickly. I actually didn't even know that there were other people blogging at the time. I just thought it was something people did for business, and I thought I was unique in doing it for fun. And it was probably a few months later that I stumbled across all the, all the Aussie bloggers on Twitter. And then shortly after that, I think that was when you announced your second pro blogger in Melbourne. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'll go along to that. I still don't even really know why I went along because I was so new to it, but I'm so glad I did. But, yeah, that's where it all started.
And then where did it progress from there for you?
So by the time I got to ProBlogger in Melbourne, so I'd started that first I Love Pretty Things blog, you know, maybe, I don't know, 4 months earlier. And by the time I got to Melbourne, I had 4 blogs. So I had my own personal Kelly Exeter blog. I had a blog for our business, which was Swish Design. And then I had also started a blog called Small Business Blog. And in my head, of course, I was going to build the following on all these blogs and, you know, create products for the readers and, you know, fast forward to the passive income dream of lying on the beach and making lots of money without doing anything. So, yeah, that was the goal.
That was the goal. Excellent.
That's not where I ended up.
Yeah. Well, one of the things as I was preparing for this, there was so much we could talk about. We could talk about, I think even in your email footer, it says you're a writer, designer, and an editor. So I was like, okay, where do we even start here? But one of the things I do want to focus in on is personal blogging, because that's certainly been a part of your journey, writing about, you know, what's going on in life and what's going on for you. And I got this question from Sally. She said, I'm wondering how much of my personal life I should include in my blog. I see bloggers sharing every intimate detail of their lives. Some bloggers doing that, while others don't even use their real name. Perhaps the answer to this is it depends. But do you have any thoughts on how personal to get in your blog? And that came in from Sally in the Facebook group. So interested to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, so Sally's right in saying the answer is probably it depends. But and I guess the what it depends on is why you're blogging. And just so you know, like why you're blogging when you first start blogging will probably evolve to something else. So you can only really address that question in the moment. So, you know, some people are blogging to position themselves as an authority in their field, and they want to maintain some distance between themselves and their readers. So, you know, those people put a lot less of themselves into their blog. And, you know, some people like blog about products. Like, remember when you used to blog about printers? I know that you put a lot of yourself into the printer post, but, you know, you're talking about them and you can do that because you're blogging about products. But I just think for the vast majority of us, blogging, the power of it comes from the connection that we get. And, you know, so we're either trying to connect with like-minded people. So, you know, parenting bloggers are trying to connect with other parents, or book bloggers are trying to connect with people who either read books or write books. So, you know, if you're trying to connect with people, you do have to bring a bit of yourself to it. And certainly if you're trying to build a personal brand, then you have to bring a lot of yourself to it. So, you know, and that's what you've done with ProBlogger. That's what I've done with The Life Less Frantic. And, you know, at the end of the day, the most powerful connections are coming from a vulnerability. But you as a blogger get to decide just how vulnerable you're going to be. So that line is hard to know where it is. And what makes it even harder is the fact that every single blogger will tell you that it's the post where they were like, I don't know, should I publish this? Should I? Ooh, and they press publish and then they run from the room and then, you know, they come back 2 hours later and bang, it's like their most popular post ever. And, you know, they hesitated to press publish because there was a lot of vulnerability in there. So it's difficult because the most vulnerable posts are the ones that get the, you know, the best reaction and the best resonance. But at the end of the day, you just have to decide what you're comfortable sharing and what you're not. And, you know, sometimes you'll overstep the mark, but the good thing is you can always delete it. And you'll know for next time that, yeah, that's where your mark is. And the mark will shift as well. Like I know a lot of people who blogged a lot about their kids when their kids were very young. Now they don't mention their kids at all because the kids are a bit older, and sometimes they wish they hadn't blogged so much about their kids when they were younger because that stuff's there forever. So yeah, it's hard to know where the line is, but I think the short story is you need to be vulnerable if you're going to connect with people, and you need to share your hopes and fears and dreams. But you have a lot of hopes and fears and dreams, so share the ones you're comfortable sharing. Over time, you'll get a bit braver about what you share, but you'll also develop a bit more of a fine-tuned, you know, balance about knowing what you don't want to share.
Yeah, and I think you know, it really depends on the topic as well and what part of you share. I know I share quite regularly on ProBlog about my fears, and a lot of those fears are to do with blogging. But you know what? I've got a whole heap of other fears as well that I don't share on the podcast or on the blog, and so I choose what part of myself to reveal.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, you sort of talk there about changing your approach, and, you know, maybe changing from less personal. And that's something that you, late last year, you wrote a post called "Time for Me to Stop Writing About My Life,"
which probably, it was a bit dramatic, wasn't it?
It did. I was like, I saw it, and I was at the time, and I remember thinking, "Oh wow, what's going on here? Is this a midlife crisis?" And then I read the post, and it wasn't quite that. But you did talk in that post about how, despite being a really quiet and private person, you've used your blog for many years to share very openly about your life and dealing with stress and anxiety and depression and overwhelm and lots more. But in that post, you talked about how you've decided to stop mining my life for blog fodder, which I think a lot of bloggers could probably relate to, or yeah, at least their husbands and wives could. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that decision. Let's start with, why did you blog in such an open, revealing, personal way for the first 6 or so years? And then why the change?
So I think when I first started my personal blog, so not the I Love Pretty Things blog, but my personal blog, like, I was quite lost. I was stressed and overwhelmed. I was fighting depression. I was really, really unhappy in life. So I was on a journey out of that. And I had kind of started the journey out of that. I'd already hit rock bottom. I was having therapy. I was, you know, doing the things to get out of that. So, and I knew that there were other people on that same journey, and I knew that they would benefit from moving along the path with me, or moving along like with me just slightly ahead of them. So that's, I think, why I kind of made the decision that, yeah. And as you said, like, you know, on ProBlogger, you share your fears about blogging. I kind of made the decision in that moment to go, right, this small aspect of my life, this bit thing where, you know, I'm fighting, you know, the overwhelm and the anxiety and the depression and the stress, like, I'm going to share about that specific part of it. A lot of people ask me, especially a lot of my close friends are quite bemused at how open I am on my blog, given I'm such a quiet and very private person in real life. And I think the reason for that, there's two things at play. So the first one is that I'm pathologically shy in real life, which a lot of people don't believe, because, you know, I've developed a lot of management techniques for not presenting in that way. But the fact is that shyness does get in the way of connecting with people. And for people who don't understand shyness, it's a social anxiety that manifests quite differently for different people. But for me, it means if I don't know you like really, really well, my assumption is you don't really want to talk to me. And if you are talking to me, I need to be adding value to your life while you're talking to me. So as you can imagine, that kind of gets in the way of good, meaningful conversations and being in the moment. When I write on my blog, I am released from that self-perceived obligation, and I'm released from it because I'm not talking directly to someone's face. And like, if they even so much as glance over my shoulder, I assume that they don't want to be talking to me and rather be talking to the person behind me. So if you're reading my blog, like, I know that you want to be there. You're making the choice to be there. And the second thing that I guess frees me up to be quite personal is that, even though when I'm writing, I do have the reader very clearly in mind, to me, they're kind of like this one big amorphous mass. So I'm not like, I'm not picturing like individuals reading my words. I'm picturing like this mass. And I think like if I pictured individuals reading my words, and in fact, I know this because in the past, like there was a period there where if there was a blogger I really, really admired, like I went through a really big Penelope Trunk phase, and I went through a Sarah Wilson phase and a Mia Friedman phase. And I kind of imagined, so every single blog post I wrote in those various phases was written for those guys, like those individuals specifically. Like I was imagining them coming to my blog and reading it, and I edited it. You know, anything I thought they would think was a bit lame, I edited it out. And I can quite confidently say that those periods of my blogging were, you know, not my best work, because I was writing for that very specific person. But when I write for the big, you know, the big mass, big amorphous mass, or the shapeless blob, that's when I'm quite free, yeah, to kind of be very personal, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because I know some bloggers are very different to that, in that they do write best when they're writing for one person. And they really tap into that person that they're writing for and come across in a more personal way. But I think I'm more like you on some levels, particularly with my speaking. A lot of people say, you're not an introvert, you're not shy. And I'm like, oh my gosh, if you have a one-on-one conversation with me, as opposed to me talking to, you know, I'd much prefer to speak to a thousand people than one.
I'm the same. And people always are fascinated by the fact that, yeah, like you, I love speaking. But to me, speaking is wonderful, because it is, you get to share your ideas, but you're not, again, because if the people are there in the room, they're generally engaged with what you're saying and they choose to be there. Whereas, yeah, when you're one-on-one with someone, like, yeah, like I said, my thought is always they would rather be talking to someone else. And so if, you know, while they're talking to you, you better make it worth their while. Yeah. So,
and I find with a talk and with a blog post and with a podcast, there's no one interrupting me. So I can present my full idea and I can know that I'm going to take my readers on a journey from A to B and not be interrupted, not be asked a question. those types of things freak me out. Whereas if I can design the flow of the interaction and be in control of that, maybe I'm a control freak. I don't know.
Anyway. I was going to say, this is your closet control freak coming out. I've never seen this side of you.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure whether I am or not, but I think we've got very similar personalities. I was reading one of your posts on that. And I think we're very similar, except you're a thinker and I'm a feeler, maybe. Is that right?
Oh, no, I'm a feeler. It's just that you're a P and I'm a J. Yes, I think that's where we're different.
You're a bit more organized than me.
You're listening to Pro Blogger.
All right, so we've established that you openly shared on your blog and that was why, but why did you decide to stop doing that or change the direction at least?
So it's something I kind of – there was a period of about 18 months there where there was – like I've just felt this kind of frisson in, you know, with my blog where I was like, I'm just not connecting with people in the way that I want to and I cannot figure out why. And it took me about 18 months to figure out that what had happened was that my readers were further behind me in their journey than say six or seven years ago. So 6 or 7 years ago, people were at the same spot in their journey as me and we kind of traveled it together. And then those people evolved and outgrew me and then they left. And then they were replaced with people who were at the start. So with each successive year that I've blogged, I've gotten slightly further ahead of where my readers are actually at. So effectively, like, my problems weren't their problems. So there was a disconnect there. And then the other thing that I found was I kind of, by the end of last year, I only like to write about things once I've been through them and fully processed them and understand them and understand the learnings that I've taken away from them. And what I found was by the end of last year, like, I had literally mined my life for every last bit of learning that I didn't have. So everything else, like, I was in the process of learning. And I don't like, you know, some people are very good at, they don't mind sharing in the moment, like, this is my problem right now and I haven't processed yet, you know. Yeah, and you travel the journey with them and that is very intimate. And I don't like doing that. I only like sharing things once I've fully processed it and come out the other side. So, yeah, so that was kind of what I'd gotten to. My readers were much further behind me than I was. I just didn't have fully processed learnings to share anymore. So that's why I decided, it was time to stop going to my life. And, you know, because every blog post was like, here's something I experienced. So I'd start with a story of something I had experienced and then I would go from there about here's what I learned, and I'd kind of run out of the stories.
Sure. So what's the change look like in reality? So what's the new style of content, I guess?
Where do I find my ideas or what do I write about now? So it took me a while. There was a good, 4 or 5 months where I was like experimenting and trying new things. And then, so then what I have now kind of discovered is I'm noticing more. So I notice what people are reacting to or responding to more, and I'll write. And if I have an answer for that thing, I'll respond to it. So like late last year, I noticed Kerry Satfor had posted something on Facebook about being a bit burnt out, and then like there was this massive string of people who like responded and said, "Wow, yeah, I don't know what it is about right now, but this is why I'm burnt out." And I just don't know what's going on. And I knew the answer. The answer was, it was the end of the year, and we all had decision fatigue basically towards the end of the year. So I wrote a blog post to address that, and that blog post went off. It got shared quite a lot. And then more recently, I shared something on my Facebook page about decluttering in a study that someone had done that discovered that you know, a really big problem for middle class families with that was that they were drowning and stuff, and it was a cause of a lot of stress. And that share of someone else's article started a discussion on my page about, you know, people had talked about how they had decluttered and how it felt so much better and da da da. So I started writing a blog post because I noticed that there was a lot of discussion around it. So I thought, oh, I know a lot about decluttering. It's my favorite hobby. So I started writing a blog post about, you know, how to declutter. And then I actually realized, oh, hang on a minute, there's a kind of a piece of the conversation missing here, and that's the fact that there's just no point decluttering if you then reclutter your house and have to declutter it again in a year's time. You know, that's bad from, you know, both the mental health point of view, but also it's pretty bad for the environment. So I flipped the post in the middle of writing it to be more about, you know, okay, you've decluttered, which is great. Everyone's into decluttering right now. Thank you to the minimalists. But now let's talk about not recluttering your house. And that post has been shared 2,400 times, which is like five times as much as any other post has ever been shared on my site. So, yeah, it's interesting. But it's interesting to me how, yeah, the more I open my eyes and the more I pay attention to what people are talking about and what's kind of on their mind, and if I have the answer for it, they're the posts that are really going off at the moment. But they've got nothing to do with me. They're not starting with a personal story. They're not sharing my experiences, but they're sharing my learnings and my research.
Right. So it becomes more of a there's an application, I guess, as a result of it. Sort of practical type stuff?
I think
topical.
That's the thing I'm known for is I'm known for not just saying you should do this and you should do that. I'm known for like the practical, like here's how you do this thing, or here are little ways that you can make this thing happen in your life, like actual things that you can do, not just aspirational things you can do.
Well, that's great. So in some ways the topic of your blog is similar, but you're presenting that topic in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just that shift from being everything before was here's something I experienced, here's what I learned from it. If you learn something from this as well, that's great. And now it's shifted to here's a problem I've noticed you guys are having. Here's my answer for it, and here's how to make that thing happen in your life. Like, I understand what your life looks like, so I'm not going to tell you to do things that are just not possible to do. Here are things I know that will actually work for you.
Well, it's great. And it sounds like readers are responding well.
Yeah, they really are. It did take a while to get the balance right. But yes, I'm certainly, and you know, certainly every blog post, I'm not hitting it out of the park, but the ones that go well do seem to go really well at the moment. There seems to be a bit of a tipping point happening at the moment for me.
Well, that's great.
Which is nice.
Yes. Well, I'm sure that helps Sally in her thoughts as well. So we might move on a little from personal blogging. And now I want to tap into some of your experience as an editor. You've been working at Flying Solo, and many of our readers will remember Robert Gerrish, who I interviewed back in episode 181. So you've been working on that site for a few years now. And a lot of the questions that I got from readers in our Facebook group came about editing posts and writing posts. So maybe if we can switch gears into that little expertise that you've got there. So we've got a question from Dan and or Wendy. Dan and Wendy seem to share an account on Facebook, and they ask about researching posts. And I noticed in that post that we were just talking about that you said you want to do more posts that will require some research. And I wonder if you have any tips on how you approach writing about a topic that maybe you don't have expertise on and that you do need to do some research on.
So I approach it not from the point of view of trying to become an expert. I approach it from the point of view of being an enthusiast. So a lot of Carly, my Straight and Curly podcast co-host, we share a lot of research in our podcast, and we always say to people, we're not trying to present ourselves as experts, but we are enthusiasts. And what that does is it means that you only share research that's interesting to you. So there's heaps of research out there, and a lot of it's very dry, and a lot of it's, you know, you could share it, but you're not going to engage the reader with it. So, you know, with regard to that, yeah, I try not to approach it from presenting myself as expert. Is I'm trying to be you, the reader, and I'm presenting you with research in a way that is interesting to you and also, I guess, actionable for you as well. There's no point sharing that, you know, 20% of people on Facebook, you know, process ads in this way if it's something that you, the reader, can't use. Like, that's a piece of research that has no interest for you. So that's, I'm not sure if that answers the question, but that's how I approach it.
Yeah, I love that. In some ways, that's what I've always done with ProBlogger, particularly in the early days, because I wasn't an expert on making money from blogging, because I was just learning how to do it. But I was presenting what I found that I found interesting, and yeah, sharing that journey and being really clear that I wasn't an expert. I think that's important too.
Yeah, and I think you as a writer have to remember, if it's not interesting to you as a writer, it's not going to be interesting to the reader. So don't share stuff that you don't find interesting just because it's research and someone's figured out that thing.
Yeah. And another question from Dan and or Wendy, who asks, do you have any – do you use standard sort of templates or outlines for posts? And I know Michael Hyatt had talked about how he writes in a almost like a templated type way. Or are you more free-flowing in the way you write?
Kind of a bit both. So my most basic tried and true formula for a post is to open with a story or anecdote that kind of introduces the idea that I'm trying to share, and then follow up that introduction or that story with some really practical how-tos or practical takeaways in you know, dot points or like numbered points. So, you know, people connect with the story, that hooks them in, and then the practical how-tos or the practical anything, the practical points, it means I'm not just telling them what to do, I'm showing them that they can actually do it. And I find that to be a very, very strong formula for a post. And I've written something on Flying Solo that kind of outlines that formula. So I can give you the link for
that. That'd be great. We'll link to that in the show notes. Yeah.
So that said, I actually don't approach the writing of my posts in that way anymore. Like, in the past, I was quite structured and I tried to outline posts before I wrote them. But these days, I free write all my posts first. And when I say free write is I've got the idea and I sit down and I put the timer on for 15 minutes and I start writing and I don't stop. Like, even if I have to write, I don't know what to write here yet. That's what I write. And what I find the free writing does is it tests the idea. So if the idea is no good, if I don't have as much to say about it as I first thought, like, that comes out in the free writing stage and the idea gets dumped. If the idea is good, then the free writing stage tends to throw up something interesting that I might not have gotten to if I'd approached the writing of it in a very, very structured way. So then after I free write the post, I let it just sit for a day, because then it marinates in my head. So, like, you know, I'm washing the dishes, I'm thinking about what I wrote. You know, if I go for a run, I'm thinking about what I wrote. And then when I go back to it the next day, like, I'm much better placed to refine it into something that's very coherent, and connects well with the reader, because it's got to connect. So yeah, I do tend to think I'm not actually that good a writer, but I'm a really, really good editor, because I'm really willing to put the time in to refine the post and make it, you know, really connect. So yeah, to me, free writing is about connecting fully with the idea, teasing it out, and then identifying exactly what you're trying to communicate. And then editing is about removing everything that does not take the reader where you want them to go, and ensures that whatever is left behind, it takes the reader on a really logical journey and delivers a really nice payoff. So that's kind of my process.
That's great. So how much changes between the free write and the edit, or is that – it depends.
quite often it's almost a complete rewrite from the free write to that, which I know would just freak out a lot of people, because in the past, I mean, I remember Penelope Trunk saying, like, you know, she would write, you know, 4,000 words to get an 800-word blog post, and I just wanted to die when I heard her say that. But that's kind of, you know, I'm probably not that extreme now, but I would probably write, you know, 1,600 words to get an 800-word blog post. So, and I think that's just the difference between being good and being better than good, if I want to blow my own trumpet. But certainly, you know, I'm a very harsh critic of my own writing, and the writing that I'm happiest with and love the most is the writing that comes from this process as opposed to the very structured process.
Creating great content and building your audience. This is ProBlogger.
Do you think the years of experience of using that structured process has helped you in the free writing process in some way? Like, was that something you had to go through to get to where you're at now? I'm just trying to put myself in the shoes of someone starting out today. Is it good to start with an outline type process, or is it better to start with the free writing as you just described, or really does it come down to personality?
I would say it's better to start with the free writing thing. And the free writing thing, most people resist it because it involves throwing away a lot of words. And that's very hard to do when you are a new writer. It's you know, you kind of think like, if I've taken, you know, the time and effort to write those words, then I should use them. But the other thing that we all do when we're new writers is we edit as we go. So we'll write a paragraph and then we'll edit that paragraph, and then we'll write another paragraph and edit that paragraph. And what that does is it makes the writing process much longer than it needs to be. And it also means that by the time you've written a post that way, you don't want to let any of it go because it's been so hard to get those words out editing as you go. And what we have to remember is that writing and editing are completely discrete tasks, and they're completely different parts of your brain that do those things well. So if you allow yourself to free write, and if you allow yourself to write crap words, which a lot of new writers don't want to allow themselves to. So a lot of new writers, they think that the best writers sit down, you know, tap out 800 amazing words and bang, like the first draft is fantastic. And the reality is the better the writer you get, the better the writer you are, the more crappy your first draft probably is. So I just think if you, as a new writer, can train yourself to not edit as you go and allow yourself to write crappy words sooner rather than later, your writing will improve faster than if you start with a structured approach.
That's great. It reminds me a lot of how I prepare for a talk. I free talk. I don't know if that's I may have just invented something, but I just get up in my room and I start talking about the topic, and it's somewhere in – as I'm talking, I find these little snippets of, that resonates with me, even though I had never thought of it before. Yeah. I'm going to, you know, note that down, and those little phrases become the points that I then build the talk around. So,
and the thing is, if something resonates with you, you're excited about it because you've never spoken about it in that way before. And then if you're excited about it, then that comes out in your talk and is so much more powerful than, you know, just talking about something you've always spoken about.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm reminded, I can't remember who said it, but it was from the advertising industry, and they talked about how they would brainstorm as a group ideas, and the things that made the group laugh or gasp, they were the things that they would make note of because they seemed to – they got an emotional response from people, and it was just a brainstorming session, and then they come back to those sort of things that seem to resonate and build it add around those things. So,
And I think the key about those brainstorming sessions and any kind of brainstorming session is there's no dumb ideas, because as soon as people get caught up thinking, oh, it's everything I say has got to be good, then you never get to those really cool little things that really resonate. So I think it's important that people remember that if you're not willing to write crappy words, you'll always be able to write, you know, good enough words, but not great words.
Yeah, that's great. So as you're talking there, it leads me into Shelley's question that she asked in the group, was what do you do when you've got those doubts in your writing, when you start to second guess whether what you're writing is any good or not? Is that a signal that maybe it's not good and you should throw it away, or is that something you need to learn to push back those little voices?
Yeah, you got to learn to push back. When I find myself in that phase, my advice to Shelley is to press publish and leave it to your readers to tell you. And the thing that's very frustrating is that some of your very best writing will not resonate with your readers. You know, and some of the stuff you think is a bit blah, you know, will. So this is the very frustrating thing about blogging. You just never really know. So it's interesting. I met Jeff Goines at a conference earlier this year, and I I kind of asked him, you know, should I, you know, I really want this year to be the year that my writing goes next level. So should I start just publishing one blog post a month, but like make that blog post completely killer? And he kind of said, no. He said, so he said, look, I'm a really big believer in publishing, you know, at least one a week, once a week, because, you know, it forces you to show up. It removes the perfectionism and the hang-ups that will come if you are trying to publish like a killer post once a month. And interestingly, of course, he's proven to be very right, because I published, you know, that post I mentioned earlier that was, you know, that gotten 2,400 shares. Like, that's not my best writing, that post. Like, the idea was good and it resonated, but it certainly wasn't my best writing. And if I was only publishing once a month, that post would never have made the cut. But now it's like the most shared post on my site ever. So, you know, I think, yeah, one, you have to get comfortable with the fact that your very best stuff will not resonate with people the way you think it will. And yeah, just press publish. If it bombs, who cares? If it goes well, like, enjoy the surprise.
Yeah, and you found something. If it goes well, you found something, yes, that resonates, so that you can then build your next thing on, or write a book about, or become known for. I think
it's key to remember there that people aren't necessarily resonating with your writing. There's lots of pretty ordinary writers technically out there, but they have brilliant ideas and they're able to talk about those ideas in a way that reaches people. So people resonate with the ideas. They're not necessarily resonating with your writing. So if there's any kind of freedom in that thought, take it.
Interesting. So Terry asks us kind of a similar question in some ways. How do you get your ideas and information into a post without sounding like you're being opinionated or self-centered or it's all about me? I guess there's another little voice that sometimes we hear as we're writing that, oh, this is going to make me come across like I'm just, you know, self-centered. How do you deal with that?
I guess that's the one big thing I learned years ago from Penelope Trunk when I did a writing course or a blogging course with her, is that, yeah, the blog post is never about you. So if you do feel like it's about you, you probably shouldn't publish it. But I guess my first rule is I never place myself above the reader. And so, you know, some people do that because that's the brand that they're trying to build. But for the most part, people don't really like feeling like you as the writer are above them. And a good way to not be coming across as self-centered is to not tell, you know, subtly tell the reader, I know more than you or I'm better than you. The second thing to remember is people do want your opinion. It's why they're reading your blog, but they want to know where your opinion comes from. So if you're just talking at them and telling them what you think without kind of giving any supporting reasons, you know, this thing happened to me or this thing happened to a friend and that's why I think like this, then you're kind of robbing them of the chance to, you know, change their thinking or learn something new or appreciate these new thoughts that you're bringing to an old topic. So I guess rather than thinking about yourself and am I self-centered, ask yourself what's in here for the reader. And if you approach all your blog posts from like you read it over at the end and you go, what's in here for the reader? As long as there's something in there for the reader, you're okay. If there's nothing in there for the reader, then you got to either rewrite the post or not publish it.
Yeah, wise words. One of the questions I get asked a lot is about editorial calendars and how much to plan ahead and how to plan ahead and, you know, how do you come up with the ideas? And Jason asked in the Facebook group the same sort of question. Do you have any tools that you use or any techniques that you use for, particularly with a blog like Flying Solo, which is very much about a topic, but there's lots of different things that you could cover within that big topic of, you know, being a solo entrepreneur. There's a lot you could write about there. How do you make sure you are not just going over the same things over and over and develop an editorial calendar that's going to appeal to your readership?
So as the first thing I'd say is it doesn't matter too much if you are going over the same topics, as long as the writer is bringing something fresh to that topic. And usually what the writer is bringing to that topic that's fresh is their own personal experience. So I strongly, strongly encourage Flying Solo contributors to come at a topic from, you know, that kind of formula that I outlined earlier, which was, here's a problem that I had, here's what I learned, here's what you can take away from what I learned in a very, very practical way. But that said, yeah, you don't want to just be writing about the same things over and over again. So so I'll go back to tools. So yeah. It's insofar as tools, like I use a spreadsheet. I know, like,
evil.
Really, oh, no. I know, I'm really low tech in, I really resist change in some things. And my husband's always trying to get me to do, you know, use, because he loves all those tools and automations and stuff. And I'm like, you know what? I really like my spreadsheet. I know a lot of people use the co-schedule to plan out their editorial calendars. With Flying Solo, I go the spreadsheet. It allows me to get that high level view of what we've got coming up, what we've published, who's up when. We build that out a month in advance. So I'm always a month in advance with content for Flying Solo, and that's because I just don't want to be scrambling for content a week out from publication. We publish, you know, 5 to 7 posts a week, so I like to have those locked in a month out, because then what that frees me up to do is then it frees me up to look at where there are holes and go to our contributors and go, oh, guys, look, I've compiled a list of, you know, if you're struggling for topic ideas, because for the most part they come to us and go, oh, I've written a post about this. Is it suitable for you guys? And, you know, most of the time it is, but sometimes it's not, and it breaks my heart a bit to knock back an article I know someone's put a bit of effort into. So I compile ideas and thoughts, you know, I read other publications, I look at, I take note of headlines that capture my attention, and then I kind of, you know, Flying Solo eyes the headline, and yeah, so then I drop it into this ideas spreadsheet, so that, yeah, in one way I want the contributors to come to me with their own ideas because they bring fresh ideas that I wouldn't have thought of. But then on the other hand, I also give direction about, like, these are the things our readers are telling us that they want, and I direct them in that way as well. So you're kind of getting the best of both worlds, as far as I'm concerned. But that's managing a site where there's lots of contributors, and you're in charge of all the content. For my own site, I've never had an editorial schedule, and I'm never ahead in writing for it. And that is because when I used to try writing my posts like 2 to 3 weeks ahead of time. Like, I think, you know, I'd listen to Nicole Avery talk at a conference, and I'd be like, I really need to do an editorial calendar, and I need to plan out my strategy. And then what I found was, if I wrote a post like 2 or 3 weeks in advance, by the time it published, I wasn't engaged with that idea anymore. And, you know, it probably didn't matter, but it mattered to me because, yeah, I wasn't into the idea. So what I do now is, yeah, I have lots of ideas. I have my in Evernote. Every time I have a blog post idea, I put it into my Evernote. But generally speaking, as I mentioned before, I will notice something that people are talking about or resonating with, like, say, you know, today, and I will free write a post, my post for Thursday today. I'll edit it like tomorrow, publish it Thursday. And it just keeps things super, super, super fresh. And certainly for my own blog, because I'm only publishing once a week, that works really well for me. So it just depends what your publishing schedule is, and also your topic and how personal your blog is. That really dictates, you know, whether it's nice to keep the content super fresh or whether you can plan well in advance.
We certainly see on blogs like ProBlogger and Digital Photography School, it's much more like the Flying Solo experience. And I see in Vanessa's blog, she writes a day or two ahead because she wants to be able to engage in the comments with energy, because that was something she just wrote and she's still excited about it, and she doesn't have to think back a month ago when she wrote the post to how she was feeling to re-engage. Yep. So, yeah.
And that's exactly where I'm at with my process. I find it very hard to engage with the comments and the thoughts people are sharing if it's something I wrote like, yeah, a month ago, and I'm like, yeah, I've moved on from that idea now. I don't care.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than not even remembering the post you wrote, yeah, because it was so long ago that you created it.
How to build and monetize your blog. This is ProBlogger.
One of the other things that I love about what you've done over the last few years is that you've been doing blogging and podcasting, which we'll touch on in a moment, but also you're doing some bigger projects and you're writing books. You've written three, and I hear you're thinking about the fourth, or started writing the fourth. Is that right?
Fourth is still thinking. I know what it is, but I just haven't been able to get to it. But I'll talk about that.
So one of the things I noticed is that you've got three books so far. One is called Your Best Year Ever, Seven Simple Ways to Shift Your Thinking and Take Charge of Your Life. Another one is on Practical Perfection, Smart Strategies for an Excellent Life. And the third one is 20 Simple Shortcuts to Small Business Success. And as I went over to Amazon to have a look at them all, because they're all Kindle and they're real books as well, they're all in different categories. You've got self-help, religion and spirituality, and business and money. So you're covering some kind of broad categories there. I'm wondering, what's the thinking behind that? How did you come up with the topics? And maybe your fourth one, I don't know, is it building on one of those ideas, or is it another category altogether?
Yeah, this is me. I'm very organic in my approach to things. It's funny because I can be very, very structured, but when it comes to kind of what I'm writing about, I do like to be very organic, and I do like to respond to a need that I see or perceive. So with Your Best Year Ever, that came about at the end of 2013, when it just seemed like everyone was just dying for the year to be over. So lots of people had a bad year that year. And I had actually in my mind been kind of writing this book, you know, for a year. Like every time I went on a run, it was there. And then it just seemed at the end of 2013 that there was a real big need for it, which was, you know, the book in my head was about simple mindset shifts that you can call on when it feels like life isn't going your way. So it seemed like there was a need for that book at that time. So I really just put myself under pressure to make it happen. I wrote that in a very short period of time, which I think we'll discuss in a sec. Practical Perfection, what that came about because I wanted to write another book, and I was like, okay, well, what's a really common problem for all my readers? And the common problem for my readers at that time was that the high standards they hold themselves to were getting in the way of them living their best lives. And this is something that had been a problem for me in the past, but I had figured out a way to get around it and, you know, be able to set goals, go after big things, but still lead a simpler kind of family-oriented life. That's what Practical Perfection kind of tackled, you know, managing those perfectionist tendencies we all have, while still being able to lead a happier life. And then the business book, I was kind of, again, and I'd been wanting to write a business book for a while. I was the editor of a small business website. I've owned a small business run a small business for 10 years with my husband. And I just felt like I had a lot to share in that regard. And I guess I was just casting around for a book to write last year, let's be honest. I was like, well, this is the one. It's time to write that business book. And I knew I knew what I wanted to write. And it was about 20 kind of simple strategies that have helped me achieve business success. So that one was, that one came out of that. I guess with all three books, they came from me listening to what people were saying their problems were and then putting together something to address those problems.
Yeah, which is similar to what you said with the blog posts, really. And I get the sense it's maybe looking for those bigger themes in the things that you're hearing again and again. That's interesting. And are you taking the same approach with book four? Is that a need you see that you're responding to, or is that something more within you that you just have to say?
Yeah, that one is responding to what you call a spark, so noticing sparks. So last year I had noticed there was, I think it was like on Thought Catalog or something, there was this post about overthinking, and it got shared, I don't know, 30,000 times or something stupid like that. And then, because I'm an overthinker, always have been, always will be, and I've always kind of seen it as a bit of a character flaw. And then, 30,000 people shared this post, and I was like, oh, clearly I'm not alone in that regard. And then Carly and I on Straight and Curly, we did a podcast episode on overthinking, and it was funny because we finished recording that episode and we were like, can we publish that? Because we're going to sound like freaks. and we published it anyway. And that just got a huge response from our listeners. Like, our listeners are very engaged, but the engagement on that particular episode was just next level, from people going, oh my gosh, I thought I was the only one who thought like this, and da 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 da. And then there was a third thing that, oh yes. So I kind of put it out there that I was thinking that my third book, I was going to call it Overthinkers Anonymous, and it was going to be about overthinking. And I started a Facebook group for, you know, people who might be interested in those themes and following the journey of the book. And then bam, within like the first week, like there were 600 people in that group. So I was like, okay, so there's definitely resonance here. So that's that. I guess it was a kind of a stage journey. Like, you know, if I hadn't seen those sparks, and then if I had kind of said, oh, look, this is what I'm thinking my next book will be, here's a Facebook group, and like, you know, 20 people joined, then I would have gone, no spark. But there is something definitely there. So now I'm kind of engaging with the people in the group and really trying to get down to the bottom of, like, what is the problem for you with regard to overthinking? What is it holding you back from in life? What's the cost of it? And then that's what I'm going to address in the book. So that's going to happen.
It strikes me that a group of overthinkers will really be useful in that process.
It's good. It's really good.
You just have to ask a question and you get a lot of responses.
It's brilliant. They're very engaged and very helpful. And, yeah, they've been amazing to date, really helping me, yeah, refine the core idea of the book, which, because this, you know, the other books I wrote in very, very compressed periods of time, and then had no energy to launch them at the end, whereas this one, I really want to do this. I want to give it a bit more time and I want to launch it properly and, yeah, do everything right with this one. I kind of look at the first three as like test books. Like, I learned a lot from writing them. I learned a lot about titles and how important the title is. I learned a lot about, you know, the central idea has to be one that resonates. I learned a lot about launching, what works and what doesn't. So yeah, this fourth one, I'm hoping I can get a few things right.
So you touched on the writing process, and I suspect you're giving it more time by the sounds of things, the fourth one. But what's that writing process look like? Is it different to what we talked about earlier with the blog post, free writing, and then that refining editing phase? Is that how you approach a book as well?
With the books, definitely a lot less free writing. I definitely try to have a structure that I write to. That worked really well for Your Best Year Ever and for 20 Simple Shortcuts, Small Business Success, because those ones, so all three books have been written in very short periods of time. So Your Best Year Ever was written in 12 days. A Practical Perfection was, the first draft was written in 30 days, and I took a more of a free writing approach to Practical Perfection, and then the editing process was so harrowing and basically involved rewriting 2/3 of the book that I'm not sure I will take that free writing approach to a book again. And then with 20 Simple Shortcuts, I again returned to the whole thing of like, okay, I've got 20 Simple Shortcuts, that's effectively 20 blog posts. Okay, the way that I'm going to write the first draft of this book is I'm going to write literally 20 blog posts. So in May last year, I wrote 20 blog posts to the topics that I wanted to cover for 20 Simple Shortcuts, and that was effectively the first draft. The reason I wrote all of those in such compressed periods of time is because I don't have heaps of time on my hands, and it seems to be the only way I can get a book written is to, so say for Practical Perfection, so for Your Best Year Ever, that was written, like, we have 2 weeks off at the end of the year. We shut our business and we take some time out. So I wrote, you know, that book in the mornings on the 12 days that we had off. With Practical Perfection, I just locked off November a couple of years ago. And again, I wrote every single morning. I wrote 1,000 words in the morning. And then 20 Simple Shortcuts, I wrote a blog post a day every day in May. Like, that method's great because it gets the book written, but it does burn you out quite badly, and you literally can't write anything else while you're doing those things. So like, I couldn't blog, I couldn't write guest posts for anybody. I couldn't go on Facebook, which is probably not a bad thing. yeah, it's very intense. It burns you out, but it gets it done. And I kind of look at the cost benefit is that, okay, it burns you out, but it's a very, very short period of time. And everyone around me understands that, okay, Kelly is not at her best right now, but it's only for 20 days or something.
So. Sure. It sounds like there were some tough patches in it. What do you do? What's your approach when that writing process gets hard, when it's not flowing, where you're hearing the little voices? Do you recommend getting away, having a break? Do you push through? What's your go-to advice there?
Yeah, I cry first.
Yeah.
no, I definitely don't recommend pushing through. Like if you're in your first draft and you're free writing, then push through. But if you're into the editing phase where structure is very important, and for me, structure is the most important thing. Like with everything that I write, whether it's a blog post or a book, like I want to take the reader on a journey and I want to deliver payoffs along the way, and I want them to get to the end knowing, feeling kind of energized that, okay, I'm going to do this thing now. So usually when I run into problems, it's a structural problem. Like I'm like, I don't know how to get them from this bit to this bit in a seamless kind of fashion. And when I find myself stuck there, I do have to just walk away, either literally, like I'll go for a walk or I'll go have a shower, or I just have to let it sit for 2 or 3 days. And usually you come back after 2 or 3 days and it's so obvious to you how to fix it, but in the moment, like you just can't see it. So that's kind of my method for dealing with those bad days.
Yeah, I find for me similarly, it's usually about how do I get from A to B, and sometimes for me I need to almost break it down into, okay, imagining the person in one state and I want them to be in another state, and what are the minute little steps that they would need to take, and that sometimes reveals the chain, the links, I guess, of you know, how to structure a post, but also how to take them on that journey. So yeah, focusing in on that change, I think for me would be the answer too. But yeah, I'm a big walker too. It all happens when I'm on a walk.
Yeah. Oh, I never had as many ideas as when my kids were babies, like infants, and I took them for a walk for an hour every day. Like I had to walk with my phone, and I was just like talking into my phone the whole idea, going, I've got another idea. It's yeah. Great.
You're listening to Pro Blogger.
So let's just shift second last shift in the interview to podcasting, because I think it's only been a year and a half, maybe 2 years that you've been podcasting.
Year and a bit, yeah, year and a quarter.
I can't believe that.
I can't believe it.
You have shifted a lot of your content creation into the podcasts that you do. You've got two, one Let It Be and another Straight and Curly, and both are co-hosted podcasts. And now if you go to kellyexeter.com to your blog, there's a lot of podcasts in the midst of all the writing as well. Let's just talk about that, Shiv. We haven't got a lot of time, but why podcasting for a start? And yeah, let's just start with that.
Okay, so it's interesting because when I first started working at Flying Solo 2.5 years ago, they said to me, oh, you know, are you interested in podcasting at all? And I was like, nope. Not in the least. Like, you know, I'm a writer. I can't bear the thought of unedited words going out into the world. But at the same time, I think this is the Tropical Think Tank that you were at. I don't know if you remember, because that was the one where you decided to start your podcast. Everyone was talking. Everyone had a podcast. It was the next big thing. And I was kind of like, oh, maybe for Swish Design we should do a little podcast or something, but I never thought about doing one for myself. And then just over the course of that year, I started getting interviewed on a lot of people's podcasts about Your Best Year Ever, and I discovered after the first few where I was like emailing the person who interviewed me and saying, look, we got to do that again, because I can say all those things I said so much better, and them kind of laughing at me and going, no, it's fine. I started to relax into it a little bit more. And then I started to actually really enjoy it, because the big difference for me between podcasting and writing is podcasting, you can go on a tangent and it doesn't matter, as long as the story that tangent is following is good. Whereas when you're writing, you can't go tangential because you lose the reader. And that's just a fact. It doesn't matter how good the story is, they'll be going, what has this got to do with the topic of this post? So, yeah, I really enjoyed being able to tease out topics, with tangents, which I can't do with writing. And then, yeah, the opportunity came in a very roundabout, circuitous way to, start the podcast with Carly and with Brooke when Jackrabbit FM kind of started out. Because the other thing was I had no time. So I was like, it's all well and good to do a podcast, but I don't have time to produce it. But Jackrabbit said, look, we'll take care of the production. All you guys have to do is record. And it was like, okay, well, let's give it a go. And yeah, it's just been, it's been amazing. I've loved it so much. I think, I've chosen pretty good co-hosts. Carly and Brooke are both like my people. So I think that's why it's so enjoyable, because it's kind of, we're creating content, but we're also getting to catch up all the time.
It's a good excuse to have a call with someone.
Yeah.
Have you considered giving up blogging after you started podcasting? Because I know a lot of bloggers do when they kind of get this bug.
I did. I didn't really consider giving it up, but I did send Brooke an email after the first few episodes came out, and I said I might never blog again. And she was like, yes, this always happens. But I think I kept blogging because for me, the big difference between podcasts and blog posts is the sharing thing. So it's so easy to skim a blog post and decide it's good enough to share, and you can share it right then and there. With podcasts, people don't generally share them, even if they're really good, because when they're listening to it, they're not in a position to share it. So what I see podcasts are brilliant for connecting really deeply with people and for people really getting to know you, because it's such an intimate medium. But I do think for the purpose of spreading ideas, and I guess my big thing that drives me with writing is I want to be known as an interesting thinker and someone who has interesting ideas. Blog posts for me still win the day in that regard.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've been over the last few episodes talking about some of the different types of content, and we're yet to get to podcasting, but I think very similarly that it's a deep connection with people, but it doesn't tend to go viral anywhere near as much as written or visual or video, all of those things. It's much easier to share. So when you're considering a topic, and this may be a little different for you because you've got co-hosts, but how do you decide whether your idea should become a podcast or whether it should become a blog post?
So generally speaking, for blog posts, I generally only write about things that kind of I've fully processed and have very fully formed thoughts on. And certainly that crosses over a little bit into the Straight and Curly podcast, because we generally speaking only share fully formed ideas there too, but they're much more like tip type things or research things around a specific topic. And even though my blog is in theory about self-improvement, like Straight and Curly is kind of like next level, it's all self-improvement, all about making yourself better, whereas my blog writing is more about, a gentler approach to living your best life. So that's kind of, how I distinguish the content between my blog and Straight and Curly. With Let It Be, like those topics are probably closer to my standard blog topics. But what I find Brooke and I tend to do in the podcast is we tend to discuss ideas and topics where our ideas aren't yet fully formed. And I quite enjoy those discussions, because they might eventually then lead to a blog post, because in having the discussion on the podcast, I'm able to more fully form my ideas and then write about them. And I will say that Brooke and I are talking about something we've not fully processed or fully across. Like, it's quite interesting for the listeners, because they're kind of discovering things in real time with us. And that's a kind of another level of intimacy there as well. It's quite fun for the listener.
Yeah. Interesting. I feel like there's so much more we could delve into with podcasting, but I'm going to keep that for another day. The last thing I want to talk about, and this is, I kind of hinted at this at the top of the podcast, as I was kind of trying to work out where to go with this, I realized that you are doing so much stuff. Like, you've got a blog, you're writing for that, you're creating two podcast episodes a week, you're writing a book a year. You've got been actively editing flying solo. You're on social media. You're a designer. You're involved with your Swiss design business. You've got a family, two kids and a husband, and you watch football and read books and go on runs. So a few questions, Kelly. This might turn into a therapy session. How in the world do you do it all? Is it routines and systems? Are you outsourcing? Are you just not sleeping? Is there some magical tool we don't know about? Tell us the secret.
Oh, I wish it was magic. I wish I had some magical tool to offer. So I guess a few things. That the one biggest thing that I do that most people probably don't want to is I get up early, and I won't say how early because I don't want to freak everybody out. But the hours before 7 a.m. in my house, everybody in my family knows that that is for me to write and exercise. So those hours are untouchable to everyone else. So if I get up at 6 o'clock, I've got an hour. If I get up at 5 o'clock, I've got 2 hours. If I get up at 4:15, which is when I get up, I've got a bit more. Those hours are so precious to me, and they are the real reason I get to do as much as I do is because my kids are good sleepers, and they know that that time in the morning is untouchable. And I guess that's one quick tip for parents in particular, is that your family will be far more respectful of the things that you do every single day than the things you do every so often. So, you know, if my kids get up, they know if they get up before 7 a.m., they go in the living room and they watch TV, and I'm not available to them at 7 o'clock, and that's, you know, every day. So if it was something I was doing every so often, they would feel much more empowered to interrupt me, and I would feel less able to go, no, you know, this is my time. But because I do it every day, like I said, untouchable. In order to get up early, I go to bed early, which means avoiding addictive Netflix shows or being really disciplined about only watching one episode. So while we were watching Suits, it really ruined my productivity because sometimes we were watching three shows a night. So I had to okay, no, one a night, that is it. And then we're to bed. The morning hours that I've spoken about, like, I make those hours count. Like, I do not use them to stuff around. I use them to write and to exercise, period. With the podcast, we record those in batches of 2 to 3 eps at a time. And we've actually just moved both podcasts to seven or eight episode seasons with a 3-week break between each season, because we were finding the publication schedule was quite full on in the scheme of what we all had going on in our lives. But as I mentioned before, you know, Jackrabbit takes care of everything other than the recording. So if I had to do anything but that, I wouldn't be able to do it. The only reason I'm able to do the podcast is because they take care of all the production and everything. And I think, like, one key piece of the productivity equation that a lot of people miss out on that I don't is that I really, really prioritize the things that are going to give me good energy levels for every day. So I prioritize good sleep. I won't sacrifice sleep. I know that's the first thing most people sacrifice when things get really busy, but I don't sacrifice sleep. I exercise every day and I eat really well, because those three things ensure that I've got the energy levels to be productive in the time that I allocate to be productive. Routines, of course, like every single thing I can build a routine around, I do. And the reason routines help you produce quality content is because they free up headspace. So, you know, between 7 and 7:30 in the morning, like, I'm doing stuff in our kitchen. I'm making lunches and making people breakfast and doing things like that. But I'm on autopilot. I'm not having to think about what I'm doing because I do it in the same order every single morning. So even though that could, in theory, be quite a busy time of day, it's mental downtime for me. And I'm actually, you know, I can think and muse while I'm doing those things. So that's what routines do for people. People who push back against routines, they don't restrict you, like, they are freedom. Yep. And I could go on about that forever.
Yeah, we could both talk about that for a while.
And then I think I do often find myself on the edge of burnout because I have taken on too much. And when I do, what I do, I just recalibrate. So say right at this moment in time, I am in a recalibration mode. So I actually finish up at Flying Solo at the end of May. I've pulled right back on the amount of guest posting I'm doing because, you know, I was guest posting 2 or 3 times a month, and that those were taking me 10 to 15 hours to write. As I mentioned, we've moved our podcast to seasons, and yeah, because, and the reason I've done all of that is because, as I mentioned to you before, like I want to get to the writing of this fourth book, and they flat out was just, I didn't want to write that book in a compressed period of time again, like I did the others. So I've gone, right, well, this is really important to me to get to this fourth book. I need to step back from some of these other commitments that I've had, and free up that time. And I think people get, they're afraid to recalibrate because it feels like, you know, they're not managing their time properly. I just say, no, it's being sensible and it's being smart to acknowledge that you actually can't do everything that you want to. You gave it a go, you did it, but now it's time to step back. And it doesn't mean that you're never going to do those things again. It just means you're not doing them right at this moment. And I do think like the biggest secret to consistent and prolific content creation is to set a standard and then hold yourself to that standard. So be realistic, but set yourself, you know, that standard. And what it is building the habit creates the discipline. Like most people think they have to have discipline in order to do these things that we're doing and do them well, whereas it's the opposite. The habits build out the discipline, and then the discipline kind of keeps you going because, you know, you get to see all these things you're producing, and that kind of creates success momentum. But yeah, build the habits, the discipline will come, set yourself a standard and you will meet it because that's what you do.
That's great. Very tweetable. I think everyone should share this podcast because no one does. They all listen. There's the tweetable. Building the habit builds the discipline. And the other one from today that I wrote down is let yourself write crappy words.
That's my favorite one. Yep.
You've got to tweet each of those. So if you're listening, if you still made it to this point in the podcast, yes. There's two little tasks for you to do. Thanks so much, Kelly. There's so much ground that we've covered there, but I really got a lot of value out of that myself. Where can people find you or what many places can they find you?
Best place is definitely kellyexeter.com.au. And if you're looking kind of the best place to start, go to kellyexeter.com.au/simple because that kind of gives you a bit of a roadmap for where to get started on my site and freebies and stuff like that as well.
Excellent. Thanks so much. And we will link to that. And I think you mentioned another resource on flying solo. We'll link to those in the show notes today. We look forward to seeing all those shares of the podcast.
Yes. Thanks, Darren.
Thanks so much.
This is ProBlogger.
Thanks for listening to that interview with Kelly Exeter. I hope you got a lot of value out of it as well. I certainly am feeling very motivated having just listened to it again. You can check out Kelly's blog and podcasts at kellyexeter.com.au. Link to that in the show notes today. I'll also link in the show notes to some of the articles that Kelly has written on ProBlogger about blog design and about writing content. The show notes are at problogger.com/podcast. /193. And also remember that Kelly is speaking at our Australian events this year, both in Brisbane and Melbourne in late July, early August. She's talking about content creation, so she's going to dig really much deeper into some of the things that she's been talking about, particularly as it pertains to monetizing your blog. She always delivers a lot of very practical and actionable information. Her sessions always get very highly rated, and that's why we have invited her back this year. You can find out more about those Australian events at problogger.com/events. Lastly, if you did enjoy this episode, you might want to check out episode 119, in which Kelly took over the podcast for the day, and she talks about choosing the right WordPress theme for your blog. A little bit of a different theme to today's podcast, but it is Kelly, and it will show you a little bit of a different side to her as well. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to join the Facebook group. Do a search on Facebook for ProBlogger Community, and you'll find it, or head over to problogger.com/groups. Thanks for listening today, and I'll be back next week with a shorter episode in episode 194, but still some actionable advice for you. Thanks for listening. Chat with you soon.
You've been listening to ProBlogger. If you'd like to comment on any of today's topics or subscribe to the series, find us at problogger.com/podcast. Tweet us at ProBlogger. Find us at facebook.com/ProBlogger or search ProBlogger on iTunes.
This episode of the ProBlogger podcast was edited by the team at Podcast Motor, who offer a great range of services, including helping you to set up and launch your podcast, as well as ongoing editing and production of the podcast that you produce. You can check them out at podcastmotor.com.